This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, sit down next to language while it is sat on its tuffet eating curds and whey.
Boom.
In this episode, I talk with Krista Couture, a musician and writer, and she is so interesting and delightful. But I must warn you beforehand that we do discuss some heavy topics: cancer, Krista's leg amputation, disability and ableism, and grief. We talk about the deaths of two of Krista's babies, and I know that's a subject some of you may need not to hear about right now. So I've put that part of the interview towards the end of the episode, about 20 minutes into the show. And I will warn you before we get there, so you know when to tap out if you need. On with the show. I was surprised to learn that the word prosthesis was a grammatical term for like 150 years before it meant artificial body parts.
Was it? Tell me.
Yeah, it was the addition of a letter or a syllable to a word.
Really? Prosthesis. I've never thought about that. I love that. As far as like pros and thesis, like what do those mean?
Pros meant to.
Mm.
So it's prostithenai in ancient Greek, which was to add to or to place next to.
But not in place of.
No.
Hmm. I love that. It's funny, it's never occurred to me to think about the root of that word. Hmm.
Speaking of prostheses, the bodily kind, Krista Couture has the most glorious one I've ever seen. Her leg is covered in this vivid floral design.
I'm Krista Couture. I'm a writer, musician, and broadcaster based in Toronto. I am also queer, disabled, Cree, and a mom.
Krista has also written a book, How to Lose Everything, a memoir in which she recounts some very difficult and tragic things that have happened in her life. And a recurring theme in it seems to be that people she encounters want to express sympathy, but do not know what to say. So then they say something a bit terrible.
Yeah, that happens. Yeah, it's interesting. I talk about my disability and losing my leg to bone cancer as a kid. And I talk about losing my two children, my two sons who died at different times. Those are very, very different experiences. And sometimes I've heard people talk about losing a child and people say it's like losing a limb. And I'm like, as someone who's lost both things, I just want to say, I get where you're going with like the metaphor. It's a part of you. Like there's something maybe there, but the realities are very different. At the same time, I've drawn some correlations between living with grief and disability, just in the ways that you have to make accommodations. You have to think about your day and think, what can I handle and what do I need and what's out there and what am I going to encounter? And there are similarities in the strange ways that people have responded to both of those things, their shock or their discomfort. I think most often their discomfort and not knowing what to say or kind of running off in a direction that they think might be helpful. It really isn't.
Yeah. Do people ever say everything happens for a reason? Because that seems like a hugely insensitive thing people love to trot out.
People love that. And to me, it's just not true. I don't find it comforting. Sometimes when I'm annoyed with that question, I try and think, okay, this person's trying to be comforting. They're trying to reach out. But over time, I became less patient and understanding of their intention, because it really denies a person their experience. It takes a person out of the present, because if something awful has happened and you're in despair or you're grieving or you're just processing and someone's like, everything happens for a reason, they're already trying to fast forward you and get you somewhere else rather than just be with you where you're at. And if where you're at happens to be on the side of emotions that are like negative or unpopular, people just really want you to get through it quickly, but it's such a disservice, and it actually is just like cutting off a huge part of our human experience to say, don't feel bad because it's going to happen. It's all for a reason, and just wait and see, and it's going to be okay. And it's like, but why can't we just find out about it not being okay? That might be interesting.
Yeah, maybe people, they just want to believe that there's some kind of order in things that will protect them from grief, but unfortunately, the platitudes don't really work that way. Or do they?
No, they don't have the effect that I think people are hoping for. Not to me. I wonder if there's someone out there who's like, I love that shit. Tell me it happens for a reason. That is going to help me through this. Like, maybe it's useful to someone. I don't know. I haven't met that person.
I think people are just so uncomfortable in grief. Like, we don't necessarily have an excellent vocabulary for expressing these things.
Yeah, we don't.
And maybe to express it would be, it's like a door that we can't open.
Yeah, I think it is. And even someone who's on this side of, you know, a number of extraordinary losses, I also sometimes I'm like, what do I say? What do I do? I and things come out of my mouth and I'm like, I don't mean that. I'm sorry. Because it is uncomfortable. And of course, you don't want someone to suffer. We don't want that for each other. At the same time, there is suffering. So yeah, how do we get through that? And what do we say? A friend of mine, you know, when talking about when you've lost a person in your life, when someone dies, for him, the best thing is always just, I'm sorry for your loss. And then to pay attention to anything that you might say after that, because anything after that might start to be your own perspective, your belief system. Like, I'm sorry for your loss, but they're in a better place. Like, that might be your thing, but those add-ons are where you're getting into tricky territory. So sometimes it's keeping it simple, I think. And yeah, for me, I mean, my advice when people ask, well, what do I say to someone who's grieving? Like, just trying to find those words that are like, I'm thinking of you. I care about you. Not like, I wish this wasn't happening, or, you know, it's going to get better, or just trying to find something that is present and acknowledges what's really going on for someone.
So acknowledge pain and don't either offer suggestions or say something that requires a response.
Yeah. The number of times I felt like I had to then kind of manage or give something back or give something more to help them through their discomfort. Yeah.
About 10 years ago, my mum had a very serious car crash and I was in her hospital room and one of her friends came and she's like, oh, do you remember John? Well, he died in a car crash. Oh, God. Do you remember Edward? He broke his pelvis. It just, I don't know why people express sympathy by scrolling through this Rolodex of doom in their brains.
Yes. Yes. Again, I think they're trying to relate. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting with losing my leg. Interesting. Funny story. because... of course, that was really hard. I was a kid. I was 11 when I first got cancer. I was 13 when my leg was amputated, you know, at a time when you already feel pretty weird in your body and you desperately want to fit in. I really stood out. I was on chemotherapy. I was bald. My leg was cut off. So things were different for me. And it took time to get used to that. And it took time, I think even into my 20s, to kind of grieve that and then be okay with it. And then there's been these other losses that are so much greater and so much harder and so, you know, present every day. And I think with my leg, sometimes people look at me and they think, oh my God, you only have one leg. That's terrible. Well, it's not. It's fine. Like, I have a fake leg. Sometimes it works great. Sometimes it's not great.
It's beautiful though.
Thank you. I mean, it looks good. So there's that. Mm. But it's just a leg. It's not a person. And there's so many other parts of my life that are harder and more beautiful. And it's an interesting thing about me, but it's not a defining feature. And yeah, I was lucky. I was lucky to survive cancer. The fact that there was a cure for my cancer was really, really lucky.
Do you remember how the kids at school talk to you about it? Like, are kids better at this because they're a little more unguarded?
In some ways. I mean, I still deal with kids all the time who come up to me and want to touch my leg and ask me things. But at the time, I think what kids do well is, like, they have all their questions and maybe they're not always appropriate. But once you kind of give them an answer or tell them why you can't answer, they move on. They go back to their thing. They let it go. But at the same time, there was a way that as a kid, I became this curiosity and I used it to my benefit. Like, I tried to make it cool that my hair was falling out and I'd make jokes about it and find ways to invite them in to this thing that was happening. But there was, of course, ways that I was teased or mocked. I remember being called cancer on a stick, which is, I mean, it's kind of funny, but at the time it felt mean. And that's, kids do that too, right? But I think the kids I was in school with, I'd always known, like we'd been together since kindergarten and that kind of thing. So there was a lot of understanding at first. But really belonging took place in the hospital where at least all the other kids were bald and we all had, you know, tubes and IVs and we didn't have to explain anything to each other. And so that was kind of a special place to just fit in.
How do you respond to people using words to you such as inspiration or brave?
Well, you know, if I'm doing something actually inspirational, sure. There's so many times with disability that we're called brave or inspirational for just standing around. There's a story in the book where I was waiting for the bus and listening to music with my headphones, already a signal that I want to be left alone. But a guy came up to me and like asked me to take them off. And I just want to say, and I was like, yeah, he's like, I just want to say, I think what you're doing is really inspirational. And I was like, I am literally just standing here listening to music. And do you think that this is a feat for me to be in the world? It reveals to me, or it tells me so much about what that person thinks about having a disability. Like they think so little of it. They are impressed that I would leave the house. And so it's actually really quite awful to be held as an inspiration for just being around. As a kid, when I had cancer, people would often tell me, oh, you're so brave. And it was terrible to hear because I didn't choose that particular challenge. Like, I think if people want to acknowledge bravery, we can look at people seeing some choices and taking the hard path. And I was a kid, and maybe there was times I coped with being sick well, whatever that was, in ways that I didn't, or even with grief. Like, I think sometimes after I lost my sons, I became really productive in that I recorded albums and started going on tours. Wow. It wasn't really a healthy coping mechanism. It's what I used, but people were like, wow, you're doing so much. I was like, because I can't sit still, I will fall apart. But there was like a value on my coping mechanism versus staying at home and drinking, which would have had the same sort of numbing effect, but people saw it as somehow like more valuable. And I'm not sure that it was. But yeah, those ideas of bravery and inspiration are rooted in people's discomfort, people's ignorance, in ableism, and in denying this part of our experience. Yeah, I don't like being called an inspiration or being called brave. I don't like when people say, I don't see you as disabled. I really, you know, we all have strengths. We all have disabilities.
It's, oh,
like,
no.
Yeah, but you can get up out of your chair pretty easily. So, and walk across the room. That's different. Like, to me, those tie together because ultimately people are using those words to avoid having an actual relationship with disability. And have a relationship with disabled humans because it separates them, it erases their experience, it projects all kinds of BS on them. And so, you know, people say it's with good intention, but I think it's actually harmful. And it just speaks to kind of like the ways with grief, like this enormous discomfort of wanting to avoid something that is just real.
I don't feel like intention is necessarily something that you need to pay attention to either, given what the impact is.
Right. And I think I'm learning how to pay less attention to that. I think my, like, I know you have good intentions, blah, 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 is from years of trying to manage other people's discomfort and being a good Canadian or whatever. It's being like, just being polite. You're right. The point is that it's ignorant and it's harmful. So let's move from there. And this is the learning moment. I mean, disabled and disability for some people land as negative words. And I think our first problem is there. They're not. I use identity first language over person first. And that's to say, you know, I'm a disabled person versus a person with disability. And that is for a couple reasons. One, because I just don't think I should have to reiterate and highlight that I'm a person. That just should be granted and pretty clear.
If you're using language, then probably a person.
Yeah, probably. I shouldn't have to, I feel like, assert my humanity. So that should be a given. But what I like about, also like about being able to say, you know, disabled person, is it can actually help highlight what is outside of me and actually doesn't have to do with my body, because I'm disabled by many things other people aren't. Like in Toronto, you know, our subway system, I think only like 4 of the stations have elevators. So there's a bunch of stations that a number of people can't use. So we're disabled by that design, you know, by structural things and systemic things. And so for me, it's helpful when I say I'm a disabled person, because then we can look at like all of the barriers that I happen to face, or someone else, what their barriers happen to be, versus a person with a disability. And then I feel like with that, we're less likely to say, okay, but how does that actually play out in your day? My disability, my particular disability, matters less in certain settings. I'm impacted by it less, depending on what I encounter. And so, I mean, yeah, that's just an equity issue. But I also, you know, because I can't extract it from who I am, as much as I can't extract being white presenting, being short, these are all I know. And the same with being disabled, at least for the last 30 years. Like it's not something, it's not an accessory, but it's something around disability that I think we see a lot. And again, it's the people's discomfort, or the, what they're attaching to the word, that there's something negative about being disabled. Like, oh no, you're not disabled. Don't say that. Like, but you're so talented. I'm like, I know. And I'm disabled.
There are words that Krista would prefer people did not say.
I wish people wouldn't use lame when they mean boring or ridiculous. The use of it to mean those things is so present. Like if it means to not be able to walk, to be injured, I don't think we should conflate that with something being uncool or tedious. As much as having an injury might be tedious or uncomfortable.
Yeah, this party's boring. That's what they mean.
Yeah. But I think for many in the disability community, because there's so much language that is hurtful or harmful or puts down their experience, it touches on that. And until we're able to say disabled without it being this negative, loaded, pitying thing, I think we should not say lame in those other ways. Like, it's not the worst word, but it touches on something very important.
Well, it's requiring an examination of the prejudices that are encoded.
There's a number of ableist words that I wish people would be more creative about finding other options.
We have a lot of other options. It's a very large lexicon.
There's many words to choose from. I don't like to hear differently abled. I don't like to hear handy capable.
Why don't you like those in particular?
I mean, they're euphemisms and they're silly. Those words always come as part of the conversation saying, but I see you, like, you're so capable. I see you as handy capable. Like this weird idea that disability is somehow going to impact every part of my being, even though there's actually very specific ways that it affects me. So those are words I want people to not use.
Interested to learn, though, that handicap was a betting term for the first 250 years of its life.
I mean, I do. It gets used in golf, doesn't it?
Yeah, and horse racing and things.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was only from like the 1890s that it was a physical disability word.
And now one that is frowned upon.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it, how it shifts?
I think actually the shiftingness is one of the things that makes people struggle with it, because they're like, I don't know what to say now, because 10 years ago I was told to say this other thing that I'm now not allowed to say. So I'm terrified to say this thing. And now I've made this conversation very awkward. And the wrong word has like escaped my mouth because I'm so stressed.
Right. Right. And I've been that stressed out person. Who's going, oh, wait, I said the thing and I know, or I didn't know. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that speaks to the power of language as well, right? Like the impact that it's having on people, or, you know, where people have asked us not to use those words. And then us being afraid of being shamed of them.
We're now at the point where you should stop listening if you need not to hear about child death. Krista has had 3 children. Her first child, Emmett, died the day after he was born. her second, Ford, died aged 14 months, not long after a heart transplant. In the years afterwards, people would ask her whether she had children, and neither yes nor no felt to her like a correct or easy response.
I mean, after my first son died, that question, for me, you know, would instantly break my heart because, you know, the truthful answer is yes, I have a son. And then the rest of the story is, and he died as a newborn. And so if someone is just, if the cashier is asking you that, like, what do you say? What do you go into? Mm-hmm. And to say no felt like such a lie and felt like I was denying him and denying myself as a mother. And so I'd be having this seemingly simple interaction and go into a real kind of existential crisis about what do I say? What do I want to say? If I say yes, are they going to get weird and give me platitudes and say, I now have a guardian angel. I don't want to hear that. Or maybe it's going to be okay. And I could really use that. And maybe they're going to understand and be open-hearted. Or if I say no, like, am I just going to spare myself this? And it's, you know, it's okay that I say no. It's not a lie. It's just to like get out of this grocery store in 2 minutes. All these conversations would happen over a question that seems maybe quite simple. And then when I had my second son, while he was living, it would be, oh, do you have other children? I was like, well, yes, no, the whole same internal dialogue. And after he died, it just kind of just became a double whammy because then the story got even harder to tell. So I was like, do you have children? It's like, well, yes, two. No, they both died. Yeah, I know. That's unusual. Yeah. Like, and sort of this kind of bigger, more complicated story to go through. And even now I have a daughter and she's 3 years old and I still get asked that question. I still struggle with it. I still don't have a like pat response. I think because it does depend on the context, who's asking, but I don't feel guilty in the way that I used to about saying no. Like now it's like, I can say no, it's none of your business, or I just don't want to get into it. Sometimes I've had to go back and be like, remember that time I said I don't have other kids? I now actually want to tell you I have two sons that died, you know, if I'm becoming friends with someone or a colleague or something like that. But it's an interesting choice when it's a colleague or at work, because it'll come up or they'll hear about it somewhere else, or, you know, and then I sort of wish that I had been the one to tell them. I once was applying for an apartment, like to sublet an apartment. And I was sitting with the landlord and filling out the application, you know, to be a tenant. And he decided to Google me because he asked me what I do. I said, oh, I'm a musician. He went, oh my God, are you on the line? And he looked me up. And the first result that came up was this headline from a newspaper that said, after tragedy, Krista Couture or something, something. And then I watched him as he started reading this article. And he was like, oh God, oh God. I guess I should rent you the apartment.
Silver linings.
Yeah, I was like, yes, please, thank you. It was such a strange attraction. So yes or no, do I have children? Yeah, it's a loaded question. I tried never, ever, ever ask it. And not because someone else might have lost a child. Maybe they have, but maybe they wanted children and didn't get to, and that sucks. Or maybe they never wanted kids and they're so tired of having to justify that decision. Like, whatever it is, there's all of these complexities around kids. And I just feel like that's a question that we shouldn't ask. It's a conversation to have with people who want to have it, but I think I try to follow other people's lead on that.
Yeah, there's sort of different strata of people with whom difficult conversations are more acceptable. And I can understand that, like, with our friends, we might talk about it. And with randoms that we've just bumped into who have decided to ask us about these intimate details of our lives, we really just need something to stop it before it starts.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you say to someone who doesn't know you very well, I had two sons who died, do you then kind of have to hold their hand through that?
Often, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it depends on the person. Now that I have a kid, and before COVID would be on the playground more often and making small talk with parents, I remember there was one, you know, mom, she's pushing her kid on the swings and pushing my kid, we're chatting. And she asked if I have other kids. And I said, yes, I have two sons, but they died. And she just looked at me and said, I'm so sorry, that's heartbreaking. And then we kept chatting. And I was like, thank you so much. It was exactly what I probably wanted to hear every single time, because it is heartbreaking, but I don't want to get into the like, oh my God, because some people are like, oh God, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry I asked. And they get into a lot of, you know, feeling bad or not knowing what to say. And I'm witnessing them go through that. And then I start to do that. Oh, no, it's okay. Like, don't worry. You know, fine. I could have said no if I wanted to. I start like explaining my internal monologue. And yeah, there is handholding with it. And I think there was times, certainly in the earlier years, where I was feeling more bitter and struggling and just in that phase where I actually kind of relished people's discomfort because I was feeling crummy and I wanted them to feel crummy too. But now I want it to be simpler. I don't want to go through that with them. And I wish that we all had, yeah, the skills to just say, that's heartbreaking. I'm sorry.
The Illusionist is an independent podcast. I say independent, but I'm very dependent on you listeners for being here and recommending it to other people and being patrons at patreon.com/illusionist, where you subject yourselves to further contents of my brain, which is very plucky of you. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is... Vatic. Adjective, poetic slash literary. Predicting what will happen in the future. Origin 17th century from Latin vates, prophet. Try using Vatic in an email today. In this episode, you heard from Krista Couture. Her excellent memoir is out now. It's called How to Lose Everything. And she also makes music. She has several records available on Spotify, Bandcamp, Apple Music, etc. Find her work at KristaCouture.com. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with editorial help from Erin Wade. The music is by Martin Austwick from PaleBirdMusic.com. Thanks to Marsha Shander. There is, of course, so much more to say regarding language and disability. Krista's talking about her own feelings and experiences here, but she's only speaking for herself. She's not the ambassador for disability. If you have thoughts to share about how language and disability goes in your life, for example, do you favour person-first or identity-first language? You can let me know. If you go to theillusionist.org/contact, you can send me a message by voice or in writing if you'd be up for having your opinions in a future episode of the show. Or if you want your opinions in the show and you'd rather not have your voice in it, you can write them down. I'll deal with that for you. Also on the website, you can hear or read every episode of the show. You can find links to the guests and more information about each topic. In this instance, I'll link to a paper about how the word prosthesis went from being grammatical to being bodily additions. You can see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words. You can follow the show on social media. And there's a lexicon page where I list each word that has been covered in the show so far. All of this is at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.